Rob said, it's something we've been thinking about doing for a number of years. Someone in the van told me we just picked up the whole Toronto Physics Department and moved it here, but I see at least half the people weren't in the van, so that's good. That's encouraging, and that's the whole point. And as for organizing, apparently I'm not all that good an organizer because I was hoping one of my other colleagues would be giving this talk, but unfortunately I wasn't able to organize that. So I'm going to tell you a little bit today about where we are with the LHC machine and the Atlas experiment, just to give you some technical background. And I'll conclude with a few slides. I've already been asked once today. I was asked half a dozen times yesterday at a meeting in downtown Toronto, have you discovered the Higgs yet? And so I have a slide titled, have you discovered the Higgs yet, at the end. So let me just go through. This is the outline. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the great successes of last year, because the machine really is a phenomenal piece of equipment and was working quite well until it wasn't working quite well, quite as well as it could have been. I'll tell you about where the Atlas experiment is, mostly over the last year, what we've been able to do with this extra time and how well we understand it at this point. And then I'll tell you a little bit about what's going on right now. In fact, I prepared some of these slides on Monday and I updated some of them again last night because there's significant progress in the last 4 or 5 days. So, is this thing going to work? Maybe not. It was working a minute ago. Let me try that one more time. There we go. So this is the LHC. I'm sure you've all seen pictures of it. The French Alps in the background, Mont Blanc, 30-kilometer tunnel here on the shores of Lake Geneva. CERN is over there somewhere. The largest scientific instrument ever built, largest number of people working on the same sort of scientific project. Tunnel's 100 meters underground and almost 30 kilometers in circumference. So everywhere I go, I try to set the scale for what that really looks like. So this is where we are here now. And that's an LHC. If you were to try to build it here, and this were the campus at Perimeter, I thought it would stretch all the way to the 401, but it doesn't quite make it all the way back to the 401. So, but it's still, most of the Kitchener-Waterloo area would fit inside.
Next phase of construction.
Next phase, not the LHC, because there are mountains and lakes, and so a 30-kilometer tunnel is pretty much it. If it was just a tunnel, that would be one thing, but it's more than a tunnel. It's filled with some of the most sophisticated superconducting magnets ever designed. This was a crazy idea of Carlo Rubbia 25 years ago, to put both beams of protons traveling in opposite directions inside the same collar mechanism, the same cooling system, and so on, to save cost and of course, with the highest possible fields to get the highest possible energy in this constrained 30-kilometer tunnel. There are 1,200 of these magnets that were made by 3 different European countries, and it's a very aggressive design, as they say, to take advantage of the maximum energy possible in the left tunnel. And for much of the last decade, those of us experimentalists at least were watching graphs like this to see how the pieces of the machine were coming together. This is just the superconducting cable, which is only one of the pieces of the ingredients. And we were watching these two curves just in time here, meant in order to be able to start doing physics in 2007 or 2008, because there's a couple of years of installation at the end. And they managed to keep between these things and get done more or less on schedule. Of course, the schedule slipped a couple of times, but... And this just shows you part of the problem they had was that things started to arrive and they had hundreds and hundreds of these magnets and no places to put them. There's been some rumors that some of the magnets that had problems got rained on. I think that we can squelch those rumors. That's not what happened, and I'll show you a little bit about what happened in a few minutes. But they're incredible beasts. And then they had to all be installed in this tunnel, and you can see this is one magnet being dragged in while the other magnets are already in place. There's not a lot of room in the tunnel for these things. And there were a huge number of these splices, and it turns out this was where the problem was. So this I got from a talk that someone gave 3 years ago saying, you know, look at how complicated it is to do all of these things. They didn't know how prophetic that would actually be. But they had to make hundreds of connections between every one of these thousands of magnets, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later on. This is lowering the magnets down. There was only one place around the 30-kilometer tunnel that you could actually get a full dipole lowered down to the level of the tunnel, and then it had to be put on that trolley or that magnet mover and driven at least, you know, on average halfway around the tunnel. So 1,200 magnets plus quadrupoles plus other things moved around 15,000 kilometers of magnet movements over a couple of years, and all at 2 kilometers an hour. One of the big problems with these things was the drivers falling asleep when they had to drive 7 kilometers at 2 kilometers an hour. And so they had to invent safety systems to make sure that, you know, like subways, that they didn't keep driving when they were... So I'm going to show you a little bit about what happened last September 10th, when they first injected beam, or maybe a few weeks after they had their first few trials. This just shows a picture of the beam being injected, the X and Y view. And this is where it was injected, and you can see it made it a quarter of the way around the ring before they stopped it. And these little green spikes are the excursions of the beam. And this all really worked flawlessly. They'd only done this sort of first quarter before the actual day of turning on the machine, so this was the first time that they'd injected beam at this point. And you can see there are large excursions, but 10 minutes later, if you see these plots, they managed to get those under control. All of the diagnostics, you know, 99% of the diagnostics worked flawlessly, and that was the only way that you can actually get a machine like this threaded with beam and started. So this is getting all the way around, and this was the first picture of the beam not only being injected, but then coming once around the machine and appearing again inside the beam pipe. That's a major milestone for an accelerator. And they did all of this within a few hours on September 10th, having only done, you know, the first 10% before that. In the next few days after that, then they started looking at beam going around. So each one of these little traces is the beam profile on a successive orbit. So the one I just showed you a minute ago would be the first two of these lines. You can see what happens when you just finally get the closed orbit going. You can inject the beam, but if you don't capture it in some sort of RF, then it eventually smooshes out here, and so you see these things getting lower and lower until the beam's not there anymore. And so this was the second day after September 10th. They started looking at many orbits and figuring out how to capture it. This is not how to capture the beam, so they turned on the RF, and it sent some of the beam to one end of the bucket and some of the beam to the other end of the bucket, but you have to set the timing and figure out how to capture it. This was them showing off, as far as I can tell, capturing it in slightly different ways, and then eventually losing it afterwards, and this is what's supposed to happen. And so this is, again, you know, the second day of playing with this machine. They were able to capture and hold the beam for minutes and hours at a time. So that's where the LHC was a year ago or 13 months ago. What I want to do is tell you what we've done, what's been going on in the Atlas experiment, what the status of the Atlas experiment is now for the next 10 or 15 minutes. It's a bit of a conundrum in Atlas now. You can't go in anymore because it's been declared a radiation zone because two particles have gone through it, and so you have to be a radiation worker like those of us on the experiment to go see it. So they closed tours down. But even if you go into the pit now, it's very hard to get a sense of scale for the experiment because it fills the whole pit. You walk in and it's right in front of you and you can't see anything. There's only one place in the experiment where you can actually look through the cavern. This is near the end caps where there's large muon chambers. And so everything was in place and installed for October of last year, and we actually ended up taking a couple of months of cosmic ray data to understand the detector as best we could. And we did that again in June of this year because we had some improvements that we wanted to make and some fixes, and now we're back in that mode again. As I say, this is the only place where you can take somebody to really see anything of interest, and so obviously this is where we took Cliff a couple of years ago when it's the same place. I think maybe it's at the other end of the detector, or maybe I should have flip the photograph. The only difference, which is important for us, is that the beam shielding is in here. So you can see, looking back through there, you can see all the way through because the beam pipe wasn't there. And this blue stuff is the beam shielding that has been installed, was installed last year, ready to go. May not have been back in June, but has been back for a few weeks now, and we're ready to go. This battery is dying on my... here we go. So this is the Atlas detector. I'm sure you've all seen cartoons of this before. I'm not going to go through and point out all the bits and pieces. The classic high-energy physics detector where the proton collisions happen at the middle here, surrounded by tracking, calorimetry in gold and gray here, and then a large muon spectrometer on the outside. These blue wheels were what we were looking through here. People don't go down and stand on the shielding when we're taking data. This is just for a sense of scale, but again, to set the local context, this is how we like to set the scale. So here is a building that you may recognize, and the detector is actually almost six stories high, so I think I got it more or less right. I was trying to judge whether these people were really 5'8" or 4'8" or something by putting them in your office, but I think it's not bad. So it's a huge detector, but as I say, the irony now is that you can't actually get a sense of that anymore because you walk into the hall and you're immediately faced with, you know, the backs of these muon chambers, and that's all you can see. This just shows the kinds of things that we were doing over the course of the last year, perfecting our maintenance procedures. We had an ideal opportunity to perfect our maintenance procedures. This also shows one of the nice things about working in a collaboration with 1,000 or 2,000 of your closest friends, because you can go through, someone has taken the time to make an animation of what it actually takes to take this detector apart. You have to move this beam shielding out of the way, you have to introduce platforms, you have to move these huge walls of muon chambers, remove the beam shielding. Eventually, I think that beam pipe will go away. maybe not, because we can just slide the detector out. So we slide this thing out, slide those muon chambers out. All of this takes weeks, 2 or 3 weeks, to actually get the detector to this point. And we had one end of it like this over the course of the summer, where you could access the electronics and fix a few things. And we plan to do this again in the 2011 shutdown. We have sort of 1% problems that we already know about and are planning for this action. So we're well schooled and well ready to do these sorts of things. That's one thing we did with the extra year. Another thing that had to be done because of this accident released a lot of helium into the tunnel. They had to beef up the environmental seals between the experimental cavern and the tunnel in case one of these helium accidents happens near the experiment. I mean, I like to say one of the good things is, of course, nobody was killed in this accident with the LHC last year. I mean, the bad thing is it was a year's delay, of course. But they've taken extra measures to make sure. And in fact, for most of the last year, we haven't been able to be in the experimental hall when the machine was not just the beam was running in the machine, but when the machine was cold or they were going to do any powering tests, for fear that some of these safety systems, which were not yet in place, would be necessary if there was a helium leak nearby. I'm not going to go through this table of all the different bits and pieces and acronyms of the detector. I'm not sure I could even pass a test of what all these acronyms mean. But just to show you that, you know, of these 80 million channels in the innermost detector, but it's something like 100 million channels of detector, we're at the 99% level. And that's, in fact, not where we were. Not where we were last year. So these are the kinds of things we've been doing. This shows the first look at the schedule of what we're up to. So we've been in 24/7 shift mode since the middle of October, 2 or 3 weeks now. I'll show you the machine schedule a little bit later on. The LHC is supposed to start injecting first beams in a couple of weeks, so we're looking forward to having all our detectors on to see first injection, lost particles, things like that. But there's lots of things we've been doing, and we're working our way through this list now, even before we have beam. And then there are lots of things we will do before we have a full energy beam and are starting to look for Higgs bosons to make sure that we understand how the detector is working and to take best advantage when we finally do get collisions. There's another aspect to this experiment that's new and novel, apart from the big accelerator and the big detector. That's the big computing system that we need. And so we've set up this worldwide grid, and I've been spending much of the last 2 or 3 years trying to sell people on the idea that the grid computing will be the next World Wide Web. CERN invented the World Wide Web 10, 15 years ago, and it's turned out to be kind of useful. I think this grid will be useful too, but we haven't actually proven that we can do it yet until we start pushing the data out. So this is CERN, the center of the grid, Tier 0, as it's called, where the first pass of raw data reconstruction takes place. Any recalibrations and re-reconstructions take place at these Tier 1s. There are 10 of them for ATLAS around the world, including one at Triumph in Canada and a big one in the US as well. And these have been all exercised. That's what I wanted to just spend a couple of slides showing you how this works. As I say, I'm not going to go through everything in detail, but the raw data comes off the detector and is reconstructed once at CERN, but it's immediately shipped to these Tier 1s where it can do reprocessing or where it can do simulations and store them for ATLAS analysts to access and study later. Then there are Tier 2s, which in Canada we have in various places across the country. From the CFI Compute Canada Awards. As you can see, there's small numbers of people accessing and working on the reconstructions and simulations at the Tier 1s and 2s. And here are the maddening crowds down here waiting for the data on their desktop computers. But all of this has been exercised. The challenge, of course, is where we get our CN tower-sized stacks of DVDs. 50 petabytes of data per year will be moved around the world. And we're already up at the 5 or 10 petabytes of data per year. Have been moved around the world and are proven to be working. So this is the early days for the grid, but I think this will be an interesting demonstration project, and we'll see what the commercial world can make of a grid. This just shows the analysis jobs in the last year since this was the run-up to the start of the potential start of data taking. You see this letdown where people were very depressed that the machine broke, and there was Christmas, and they didn't think they had to get back to work all that quickly, but over the course of this year, we've really started pushing the grid, as they say, submitting thousands of jobs. You can't see the scale here, but 30,000 jobs per day. The red bit down here is jobs that have been submitted to the Canadian Tier 1, and you see it's steadily working and producing 5% of the computing that's used by the grid. And these are the data transfers in a 2-week period where we really tried to push things in June just to make sure we would be ready for first data. And again, I think it's the gray things where the data received in Vancouver and being used. But you can see this goes steadily now, more or less. It was a 2-week test and it was a big success. We've actually taken a lot of data, not Higgs search data, but a lot of data. There were 300 million cosmic ray events taken last year when the machine, well, even while we were waiting for the machine to get going, and then afterwards we spent a month taking more data when the machine had its problems. Again, we took another 100 million in June and July. We made some improvements, and we wanted to test them and make sure they were working. I'll show you a couple of plots. We've been using this data to exercise our data approval scheme. So there are over 300 plots that have been produced to show people around the world and our competitors what we can and can't do with our detector. And there's plans to publish a number of papers of order 8 or 10. And some of them will actually be cosmic ray fluxes 100 meters underground in science journals, not just detector papers and the quality of detector work. So the first of these are starting to come out, and we simulate them, and we see what they're doing, and we make sure we understand everything about what's going on. As I've said to many people, our understanding of this detector's performance is better than any experiment I've started. I guess this is my fourth experiment that I've started, and we always say we're going to have 6 months, 6 weeks, 6 days, 6 hours of cosmic ray running before we start taking data, before they make first collisions. We've had more than 6 months of cosmic ray running now. And we've used it to good advantage. This just shows a whole host of these 300 plots that show hit rates in various detectors and energy distributions and alignments and back-to-back cosmic rays and so on have been enormously useful for figuring out what's going on with the experiment. This just shows one of the single events coming through, hitting every single subsystem, going somewhere near the interaction region. Of course, not many of them do. They come through and go through at weird angles. The rate of cosmic rays, even 100 meters underground, is hertz or hundreds of hertz. I mean, for this muon spectrometer, it's huge, 40 meters long, 26 meters in diameter. So it has a relatively high rate of cosmic rays. And this just shows the kind of improvement we got from the running that we were doing last October. You can see the outer muon trigger chambers were working and you know, probably at the 70% level or something. But over the course of the year, we finished installing. There were some that were just not even installed here. Others were not working fully efficiently. Now we're up to, as I showed you in that previous table, 97%. So this has really, really been useful for detectors like this, in fact, for all of our detector systems. Indeed, this is the one that I built, which is the detector abort system. It's got 1 square centimeter of active area down here right next to the beam line to look for beam splashes and things and abort the beam. But I think this augurs well for our ability to find rare things. We found a cosmic ray that was coming in sideways 100 meters underground through the detector. It hit the transition radiation tracker. It hit the four layers of the silicon detector, and then it came out and hit our beam conditions monitor. We have 10 of these, and we've been studying them in great detail to try to measure the efficiency with 10 events. And as I said, these are the kinds of things we'll be doing in physics. And so we have the people who know how to find these 10 events out of the 200 or 300 million that we have and use them to best advantage. Okay, so what I want to do for the next 10 minutes or so is tell you where things are really right now. There was this accident. I'll show you one photograph of it. I got these from the Director General, who presented these to the funding agencies when they were in CERN 2 weeks ago. And as I said, I had to update some of them because things have changed in the last 2 weeks for the better. There were a number of magnets that needed to be replaced. 40 of the 1,200 dipoles had to come out. In fact, there were only 4 or 5 that were a complete write-off because of this electrical accident. But one of the problems was that there was the helium escaping produced a pressure wave that went down the tunnel and knocked another 30 or 40 of them off of their stands. And so those were taken out, taken to the surface, refurbished, retested, and some of them have been reinstalled. I don't think they actually have 40 spares. They certainly don't have 40 spares anymore. They're down to ones and twos of spares, and they're building some more. But this was a big deal, getting these things back out again. You saw some of the complication. And of course, it wasn't the closest place to the access point. In fact, it was one of the hardest places to access. But that's just the way it works. And so they put in some new mechanical supports to actually hold the magnets better. It would have been better in retrospect, they learned, to have some of the vacuum membranes blow out rather than to have magnets blown off their stand and have to take them out and repair them. So they put in 1,000 or 1,500 of these support feet to hold things so that if there's an incident again, it will be localized to fewer magnets and in principle be repaired a little bit quicker. They put in a new set of pressure relief valves all along the top of these things. They could only do that on some of the sectors. I'll show you later. About half of the sectors ended up getting warmed up again to room temperature because they don't have enough place at CERN to store all of the liquid helium that is in this machine on the surface. So they did a complicated musical dance. They can only store even a little bit less than half of it, about 3/8 of it, I think. But they managed to get a fourth sector warmed up after they had done some of this work on the on one and cooled it back down again. And I'll say a few words about detector systems that they've added to try to catch incidents like this sooner, now that they know they can happen. So here's a picture of the machine again. As they say, here's where the incident happened. Here's the main CERN campus. So it's not the very worst possible place, but this is where the magnets get lowered down. But it's most of the way around, and it's under the mountains up here. So that is one of the more difficult places to access. This is where the mechanical pressure wave happened, and various debris and stuff was blown down the tunnel. So they had to clean up the beam pipe and so on. I'll show you a picture of that. And then they put in these new machine protection systems all the way around the ring. And at various places, they've been able to put the new pressure relief valves in black here and in this region. Those were the four sectors that were warmed up. So I don't have a lot of pictures. The CERN DG doesn't show lots of pictures of the accident anymore. But this is what the cryogenic feed-through and the power feed-through for one of the quadrupoles nearest the accident looked like after they cleaned it up and made it beautiful for presentation. There are some more dramatic pictures on the web, but I didn't pull them out this time. And of course, they had to clean all that up and fix it, and as they say, improve some of the mechanical supports and so on underneath. This is a picture inside the beam pipe. There's actually a copper screen that prevents the heat from the beam actually getting out into the magnets and warming them up and making it harder to keep them superconducting. So all these little holes are to allow RF fields and stuff not to build up inside this copper screen. So red is good. That's what the copper is supposed to look like. Bits of crap inside it are not good. That's stuff that was blown a kilometer or more away from this incident, came down the beam pipe, and certainly covered in smoke and soot and ash is not good. Some of these things were actually replaced. And so all that's been cleaned up now. As I say, to protect against incidents that, like the one that happened last September, there's a new sort of current monitoring circuit on all of the magnets that's supposed to be more sensitive and catch events where the magnet is starting to go normal. That's what we call it quench. And it's supposed to do it at a lower threshold level. So they had sort of engineering designs and at some level working at Fermilab for the last 10 years and looking at what they were doing to prepare this machine. Many of my friends said, they're very theoretical about what their machine protection system should be. Theoretically, what they had should have been okay, but some of the incident, some of the causes of the incident weren't anticipated, and so you know the belt and suspenders kind of mechanisms weren't quite in place, and they are more so now. They did a careful inspection of all these magnet splices. I'll actually show you a couple of photographs in a minute. Half of them they could only do at about 80 Kelvin. That's as far as they could warm it up because they didn't have anywhere to put the cryogens other than in the magnets themselves. The other half they did at room temperature, and that's much easier, of course. That when it's cold, the superconductor has a low resistance, and so it's very hard to see nano-ohms of resistivity and tell 10 nano-ohms from 1 nano-ohm and say, yes, there's a problem. Whereas at room temperature, if these problems you have, you can see it goes up to many micro-ohms or even milli-ohms, and they had to fix things. And they added these relief valves, as I said a few minutes ago. I'm not going to go through this. There are 440 of these quench protection systems around the ring, and they added various pieces to all of them to improve the sensitivity, and those have been added all the way around the ring. So they should be much more ready to see excursions or deviations like the one that led to the incident last year. This is their best understanding of what actually happened. This is not, of course, the splice that was disintegrated in the incident, but it's another one. Unfortunately, they found about half a dozen other places around the machine where you can see this is an X-ray of the superconducting cable, and it's all encased in copper. I'll show you a slide of why that is in a minute, but of course, if the superconductor goes non-superconducting for some reason, if there's a quench, then you have to get the current out through the copper, and you can see there are places where the solder just didn't take. In these 1,500 brazes, they now admit their quality assurance was not everything it could have been. And so when that happens, let me just show you a cartoon like this. What's supposed to happen is you've got your superconductor carrying your 10 or 12,000 amps of current from one magnet here to the next magnet over there. And these were the things I showed you on that picture before. So that's supposed to go through like that, but then there's these almost 300 square millimeters of copper around that are to absorb that current if things go normal and they have to be soldered together. So if there's a quench and the magnets start to warm up, the superconductor is no longer superconducting and you've got to get that 12,000 amps out somewhere in sort of 10 seconds to a minute, depending on what kind of magnet it is. And so the copper has to be there, and the current has to get through this splice, or else you can have problems. Indeed, if you have a few of these, and as I say, they found a half a dozen more that they fixed, then the current is fine as long as everything stays superconducting, because the current is going through the superconducting cable. But if a quench happens, then the copper, you know, the copper absorbs the current here, but it can't absorb it there, and so this place is very vulnerable to heating up and melting. And so that's their understanding of what happened, was a flash spark occurred here when this cable melted, and that eventually released all of the helium, which caused the real mechanical damage. So this just shows a picture of one of them repaired with some level of quality, as I say, at room temperature, where they can repair them. They're sort of tens of microohms or better, and they had a few that were at hundreds of microohms, and they repaired them. And so you have to put solder in. When you're soldering things, you should put solder everywhere. They know that, and you know, it's a 2 years worth of quality assurance. The fact that 10 of them stuck through, as I say to some of my other friends, it's not an Airbus, so nobody's going to die immediately. But if we had 10 times more resources like Airbus Industries has, you know, we would have caught these sorts of things, but it's R&D, so we're doing R&D. This just shows a picture of all of these interconnections. There are a bunch of them that are inside the magnets, and of course every magnet had been run to full field on the bench and tested and it quenched a few times. The real trick is, of course, when they quench, there's an enormous mechanical juddering that happens. And so you shake things, and in principle you could shake these four connections loose. As I say, most of these connections are inside the magnet, so they've been tested, but a large number of them, a couple of thousand out of 20,000, were made in situ in the tunnel. That was the only place you could make them, was when you brought two magnets together and were buttoning them up to produce a closed circuit for the machine. So they had these 2,000 or 3,000 things that were susceptible. And they really, they looked at them very carefully over the course of the last year. 35,000 manual measurements were made. About half of them, as I say, were able to be made at room temperature. Some of them were made both at room temperature and cold. As I say, it's very hard to see what's going on at this 80 Kelvin temperature because the resistances are so much lower. But you know, they found a few, as they say, I think it was in the sector 6-7. They weren't planning to warm it up, but they had to because they found them at the cold temperature. Maybe it must have been 4-5. They found them at the cold temperature, warmed it up, indeed confirmed that they needed to resplice a couple of magnets, did that, tested it at room temperature, found no others, and cooled it back down again. So they have some confidence that they can see these things if they're real outliers, even when it's cold. But they will go through and double check all of these things in the next year or so when we actually have time to check the other half and, of course, put the relief valves on the other half. So this brings up the question of what energy we're going to operate over the course of the coming year or so. As I say, the worst magnet they measured and weren't able to repair was 53 microohms at room temperature. So there were a few in the 100 microohm range that they did repair. In 50 seconds from the dipole or 10 seconds from quadrupoles, it's possible to extract the current for 7 TeV. That's about 7 TeV in the center of mass. It's about 8 or 9,000 amps going through with up to 120 microohm connections in the copper. And so these are simulations, of course, as to what should happen in this overheating and whether you can produce enough energy to melt the superconducting cable junction. And so that's one of the reasons that they've settled on this 7 TeV. They think they can probably go to 10 TeV. That would be safe to 70 microohms, so there's less of a margin here and less conservative assumptions about how much cooling you can actually get from the helium gas around these cables in the interconnections between magnets. So the plan is to start operating initially at 7 TeV, giving a factor of 2 safety for the worst bars that they see remaining, including their reasonable confidence of what they were able to measure at cold as well. Gather more data. As I say, one of the real killers in this is if you have a quench and the magnets move a little bit, they don't move by centimeters, but they can move by millimeters, they could in fact exacerbate some of these poor connections. So they will look very carefully after they've had a quench at the connections between magnets in that area to see whether there's any evidence that these resistances are changing. And based on that and the validation of their simulations, they believe they'll be prepared to go to 10 TeV later in the year, next year, without going back and intervening on the rest of the machine. But then, of course, after 2010, they foresee a 6 or 8 month shutdown where they're going to do the other half of the machine, get rid of things even down below 53 microohms to be able to get up to the full energy. And this is the other thing that went into that discussion. Of course, they consulted with the experiments to see what we wanted to do. We want beam. We want to look at collisions inside the detector. I'll say more about that in a minute. But this just shows the sort of relative luminosity or the relative cross-sections, essentially, and acceptances, I guess, for various kinds of physics, Zeds, top quarks, potential new physics, W primes, and so on. And you can see how it comes down. I mean, it's not as good as 14 TeV, which would be even off the edge here. But it's, you know, within a factor of two, and as you'll see in a few minutes, we're not going to collect all that much luminosity at 7 TeV, but, you know, it's better than three or four, obviously, for new physics reach. So the plan now is to go to 3 TeV, 3.5 TeV in each beam as quickly as possible, as quickly as they're capable. And this just shows where things are right now. As I say, this press release came out on Monday. These are the beams back in the first sectors, the first arcs of the LHC. So yes, they are starting to inject beam. There isn't going to be a September 10th day where they invite the media to stand in the control room and look at all. They learned their lesson on that one this time. So we're going to go through progressively. It's a 4 to 6 week process, as I was telling people, and I'll show you here. Yesterday, these are some beam splashes inside the nearby detector, and so they're starting to do that. They're almost back to where they were on September 10th last year, although beam hasn't circulated all the way around the machine. I'll show you that in a minute. They're actually commissioning all of the electrical circuits to 2,000 amps. They really have a strong push on to collide some beams before Christmas, and this actually will only allow them to go to 1.1 TeV. My friends at Fermilab say, I wonder why they picked 1.1 TeV. Well, it will make 2.2 TeV collisions in the center of mass, which will be 10% higher than than Tevatron collisions. There won't be a lot of data. They're not going to find the Higgs or anything with that. But the idea is to get to the highest possible practical energy before the end of the year. There will be some collisions, though, even at 900 GeV, because, as I'll say in a minute, cosmic rays are nice, but tracks coming from the interaction point are really that much more valuable, so we need to get some of those. Then they're going to spend a few weeks in the new year commissioning up to this full 10,000 amp current, which will allow them to make collisions at 7 TeV. Is that February? Is that May? It's a process, and they're going through the process, and they're going through it a little bit more conservatively and carefully than they did last year. We'll see when we get there. These are the kinds of things that they have to do. Get the beam injected in first turn. They definitely got that. Circulating beam, they got that last September. Looking at some of the details of the beam can take 2 or 3 or 4 days. Then they will start thinking about ramping them initially up to 2.2 TeV for collisions. But you can see it's sort of a 30-day process, and that's really starting. I think I have it on the next slide. That's really starting in a couple of weeks. So there was this first injection test. This was last weekend, and it was successful. That's why there's the press release. We're in this week now, so they're in the final commissioning of the hardware circuits up to 2,000 amps. They've had a safety review. I think that's what DSO means. So then there'll be final machine checkout and you know, first injection and collisions potentially in the next month. So it's the next 3 or 4 weeks is the key window. I'm actually on my way over on Sunday to commission the abort system, so I'm going to be on shift for these 10 days, and we are actually promised an opportunity when they have some beam, probably somewhere in here, to throw the switch and see whether the beam goes away. So that's an important milestone for our abort system that we've built a part of at the University of Toronto. But you can see, some of my colleagues say, well, gee, are you really going to get your collisions in the 3 days before you stop for Christmas? And they really are planning to stop for Christmas. We'll see. It's a process, and they're working their way through it. So as I say, things have been moving fast. This is just a view of the machine and the temperatures in the machine a month ago. And you can see the sector where they did the repairs was still not completely down to the operating temperature, but it was getting close. And these were the various sectors and their phases. Still 5 of them were being cooled, and a few of them they started putting testing the electric circuits. This is yesterday or the day before yesterday. It's now all at the operating point, 2 or just below 2 Kelvin. And you can see most of them are into the second and final phase of commissioning the power up to 2 TeV or 1 TeV per beam. But there are a few that need to be done. Clearly, Sector 3-4 is a little bit behind. But they're doing this all in parallel. In the next couple of weeks, they will be finished and ready to put beam in. This is the European for we're working through the process. In 2010, as they say, there's 6 weeks or so of final commissioning up to the full energy. And then this is what the running schedule looks like. In principle at 3.5 TeV per beam, and then later in June or July, assuming that they're able to convince themselves that quenches haven't caused any more high resistance connections to appear, they'll move up to 5 TV, four and a half, 5 TV. They haven't promised us. The goal is 10 TV if it's safe. And we'll run through the year and even do some heavy ion physics running at the end of the year, it says in this very draft schedule. So it's a full year of running that starts earlier, and CERN has obviously made a strong commitment. They usually don't run at all in the first quarter of the year because electricity costs them a lot more, but other things have cost them a lot more in the last year, so they're prepared to put the resources in and start, basically keep going. There's going to be a couple weeks stop here. Okay, so I think that's almost all I had. I just wanted to say a few words about, have you found the Higgs yet? The detectors, as I say, are extraordinarily well understood by the standards of any detectors I've seen commissioned before. We still need tracks and jets and photons and things to come from the collision point. There are a few muons that have done that for us by accident in cosmic rays. But even getting a few hours of 900 GeV collisions will revolutionize our understanding of the detector yet again. So there's a strong push to do this before we get more adventurous and do other things. And then we need to walk before we can run. There's minimum bias, QCD physics. Jets up to and beyond the Tevatron energy, top quarks. They're looking forward to the first top quarks produced in Europe. I was actually there 15 years ago when there was a race for the top quark between the UA2 experiment and the CDF experiment, and they lost. So this is their revenge. Down here is their revenge. Obvious physics signatures may hit us over the head in the 2010 data. Z prime, SUSY, black holes, if they're there, we should be able to have the data to be sensitive to that over the course of the next year, assuming there are no further setbacks. But the Higgs itself, especially a low-mass Higgs, which seems to be the way the Tevatron is pushing us now, is one of the most challenging signatures that these experiments will ever face. This is a 3 to 5 year data-taking prospect to actually pin down a standard model Higgs. And so it's not easy, and when Peter Calamaya, the Toronto Star, asked me about the great excitement in 2008, I said, yeah, but don't come back in 2009 and ask me if we found the Higgs yet, because it's going to be 2011 or 2012. The other word of caution, and one of the good reasons to have, or one of my motivations for having a workshop like this, is you'll get to see what some of our students are doing with the data, is that even when we have a few hundred inverse picobars of data, and the Z prime or SUSY is knocking on the door and is obvious, we need to collect, we need to analyze, we need to recalibrate, reanalyze, understand our control samples, known physics samples, you know, find some top quarks, convince ourselves and convince 2,000 of our closest friends to publish that we really understand everything. So again, it's not going to be February 12, 2010, the LHC discovered the Higgs boson or something else. It will have been a process of a year or two to get this under control, almost independent of how much data we have. Of course, the good thing is there is the CMS experiment, so there'll be some natural tension there, but neither of us will want to be shown to be terribly wrong. So there's another sociological step to this process in addition to the technical step. I just picked this slide up from an ILC workshop that happened a couple of weeks ago in Santa Fe. Of course, as you know now, the ILC is the next machine, which may be 10, 15, 20 years down the road, but they're now resigned to and have accepted their fate that the ILC physics case will be made based on what physics is seen at the LHC, and they're very keen to understand what physics the LHC will have seen by 2011, 12, or 13 when they think they may be in a position to make another bid to bring the world together to commit to building the ILC. And so this was Peskin's summary of the kind of physics, and as I say, a few hundred inverse picobarns or something will allow us to do standard model physics, and that's what we'll be doing. So I was glad to see Michael actually understands what we're about here for the first couple of years. As I say, there may be obvious signatures like this, but even if we have it in the data and are sensitive to it, we may not be having it in the New York Times that time either. But then we go further on then to full energy running, presumably long before, by 2011 or 2012, and collecting these full data sets, of course. These are the nominal low luminosity running LHC years and high luminosity running LHC years, and everybody thought that would be 2008, and that was always a little bit unrealistic. So but we're going to use all of this data, as I've tried to show you, to understand how the detector is working and so on. So I just want to summarize and conclude. I think it's easily one of the most complicated instruments that mankind has ever tried to construct, and there have been some glitches. It's not a human safety issue, so it doesn't have the order of magnitude more engineering, as they say, that an Airbus 380 has in it. On the flip side, the Atlas experiment and the CMS experiment too is more than ever ready for first collisions to see tracks and jets and things coming from the interaction point and do the next phase of commissioning and understanding our detector. We expect some collisions, but it's clear that the LHC machine and LHC manager, or CERN management will proceed cautiously in energy to collect data along the way so that we can push our understanding to the next level, even if it's not pushing our physics understanding to the next level. But we can push our physics understanding with a fair data set at 7 or 10 TeV, which we should be able to take if things go reasonably well over the course of the next year. It will take a longer shutdown at the end of next year, a 6-month or 8-month shutdown to complete all these safety systems and valves and test the last few splices at room temperature, the last half of the splices at room temperature, and repair the remaining ones. And so there'll be something of a pause, and then we'll come back at 10 or higher TeV in 2011, hopefully. And I just wanted to conclude by saying, you know, Canadians are fully integrated in this effort. We're 5% of the Atlas experiment by some metrics. 60 or more graduate students, including 10 or so who are here today. We have this Tier 1 center and the analysis resources from the CFI and Compute Canada Consortia to be major players in first phase physics analyses, and hopefully you'll hear some of that later today. So that's all I had. I'm happy to take any questions.
So with the cosmic ray data, are there any subsystems that are either not calibrated or poorly calibrated that you just can't get at with that data?
No, so my beam abort system was one of the last, because you can see from the angle and coverage of it, it's really hard to get a particle to go through there. And the fact that we've been able to pull that one out, that's what's been responsible for this table I quickly flashed of 97 to 99% working. There are a few known issues that we couldn't get into the heart of the detector to repair, and so we're stuck at the 1 or 2% level with power supplies or things. But no, every system is ready to go, and now it's more the trigger and data acquisition system. It's been taking lots of data, but to really understand what a jet signature or an electron signature looks like, that's what we're looking for particles coming from. They're triggering on cosmic rays, and they're working in practice, but to actually get the algorithms working in collider mode will be the main focus of what we do with the data for the next couple, 3 months.
For example, how long will defanging
take? Well, that's a longer process. That requires everything to be working, the pixel detector and so on. The pixel detector is seeing cosmic ray tracks and is all aligned, so it could go reasonably quickly. You know, simulations say we don't really need to refine the alignment much more, actually. That's one of the nice things. In fact, cosmic rays in some sense are better than particles from the interaction point, because particles from the interaction point bias you to how you can align the detector. Having things going through it at odd angles and working all those things out ahead of time is a big advantage. And CDF and other experiments that I worked on, we came back to cosmic rays 2 or 3 years after we started taking data to discover that we had distorted the detector in our alignment procedure. So some of that we've learned and are working from the other side. But you know that. We're also doing physics studies looking to see what we can do without B-tagging, and I think those will be some of the first things. Obviously, Z primes or something to electrons or muons will be the first kind of thing that come out. So, you know, it's in the first years, but I think it's anyone's guess whether it's, you know, 2 years or 4 years away before we really have as efficient a B-tagging system as our Monte Carlo say we could have. Yeah.
Do you expect competition from the Tevatron regarding finding a Higgs?
It's a really interesting time for the Higgs, because as you know, at 160 or 170 GeV, where the Higgs couples to W pairs, it's been ruled out by the Tevatron now. And they're going to be marching down 150, 140, they may get to 135. They don't have enough luminosity. That was the scientific assessment I made 3 or 4 years ago when I moved full time to the LHC to get a 5 sigma signal to say you have seen the Higgs anywhere. So they could rule it out. They might even rule it out to 130 or 120 GeV. I've actually been measuring the W boson mass, last thing I did at the Tevatron, and it says the Higgs, you know, the electroweak corrections say the Higgs should be 90 GeV. So I'm very much looking forward to when we find a 90 GeV Higgs at the LHC, why LEP missed it. But it's an interesting sociological experiment that will go on, because they will push the limits down. Unless, of course, they start to see hints, and then they'll get sort of hung up at 2 sigma or 2.5 sigma, and you know. But having said that, you know, and having joked that we could see a Higgs of 100 GeV, that's really hard for the LHC experiments. It's just so low down in our trigger phase space and analysis phase space that it's, you know, if it was 100 GeV, now we're talking the full first phase of the LHC or something to really understand what's going on. 115 GeV, if LEP is right. So competition, I don't know, but it would be interesting to see. you know, if they get a 3-sigma signal, then they will presumably publish something that says we have seen some potential evidence for, but not 5-sigma, and how quickly we can confirm that. That'll be one of the scientific stories for the next 3 or 4 years, sure.
Just one question on your Michael Peskin slide.
Mm-hmm.
What were the LL and 3L that were, I think, in like the...
I don't know. Heather was there. Weren't you there, Heather? LL and 3L?
Yeah, on the 2012.
Yeah, so supersymmetry can make trileptons.
But is that just seeing it in standard model, think things like boson production?
I think that's right. I think it's ZZ and stuff making sports. I don't know. Pierre, do you have any idea what else 3-leptons could be?
No, that's supersymmetry.
That's a supersymmetry detector signal. As they say, Z prime to 2 leptons or Zs to 2 leptons, that's what we're going to be doing now. Make sure we understand that. Michael didn't put anything with B tagging. Sorry about that. But somewhere down here, maybe he started to get into B tagging. TG bar resonance? Okay.
All right. Let's make landing.